Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York and the Mostly Swing States Radio Network, welcome to a convention night call-in. Good evening, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer. And for those of you who were with us last week, welcome back to our informal network of Mostly Swing State public radio stations, WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio, WUSF Tampa, WCPN Cleveland, Wisconsin Public Radio, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, WDET Detroit, and WAMU, American University, covering Washington, Maryland, and Virginia, the Mostly Swing States radio network. And as we get ready for tonight's convention speakers, we have some great guests lined up, including the DNC chair herself, Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Congressman Steve Israel from Long Island, and more. Up first in just a minute, Todd Purdom from Vanity Fair. But here's our first call-in question for the week. It's the same question we did for Republicans last week. Tell us about something from your own life that has helped to make you a Democrat. We got some great stories last week about what happened to people or their families that helped to shape them as Republicans. What about for you if you're a Democrat? I promised we'd do it for you, too. And here it is. Tell us about something from your own life that has helped to make you a Democrat. Our phone number is 1-800-543-2543. 1-800-543-2543. This is an easy one to remember. Just count it down after 1-800-543-2543. Tell us about something from your own life that has helped to make you a Democrat. Was it something early in your life? Something from the last 4 years? Unemployment, foreclosure, being helped in your business by the stimulus? Whatever your personal situation was, what has happened to you? Not something you read online or saw on MSNBC. What has happened to you in your life that has helped to shape you as a Democrat? 1-800-543-2543. Now, while your calls are coming in, we have Todd Purdom, national editor and political correspondent for Vanity Fair, live from the Democratic Convention. Hi, Todd. Thanks a lot for doing this.
Hi, Brian. Glad to be here.
So help us make the transition. The Republicans made their case last week. What do you think the Democrats most need to respond to from the various speeches that Mitt and Ann Romney and the others gave?
Well, several things. I've just been listening to a bunch of speeches in the hall by overwhelmingly Latino officials, and they're responding to this notion that the American dream isn't somehow President Obama's dream. The Republican said that over and over again in Tampa last week, and in some ways it was a sly way of saying that President Obama was un-American or maybe, not American. So that's been one thing they've been doing tonight. They're obviously going to counter the notion that he hasn't done anything about the economy. They're going to talk about how conditions were when he took office. I was at a breakfast briefing this morning where Stephanie Cutter, the campaign deputy campaign manager, Jim Messina, were talking about how many hundreds of thousands of jobs had been lost in the 6 months before President Obama took office. So they're going to try to say that if people individually do not feel 100% better off than they did 4 years ago, the country as a whole is in many important ways better off. Hmm. Or as Vice President Biden said over the weekend, GM is alive and Osama bin Laden is dead.
Indeed. Well, let me replay go ahead. You want to finish your thought? Go ahead. Finally, what?
Tonight, I think Mrs. Obama is going to talk about how the president did some of these things, like health care reform, the auto bailout, the financial reform that may not have been so popular, but came out of a place of deep belief in principle that he needed to get things going again in the country. And she's apparently going to talk about that from her own perspective of watching how much he cares about this, or she often says how many gray hairs he has now that he didn't 4 years ago.
And we will get back to more talk about Michelle Obama's forthcoming speech tonight in a few minutes. But here is a centerpiece of the Romney argument from his speech on Thursday night.
If you felt that excitement when you voted for Barack Obama, shouldn't you feel that way now that he's President Obama? You know there's something wrong with the kind of job he's done as president when the best feeling you had was the day you voted for him.
So do these delegates, Todd, acknowledge being any less excited about the policies or results of Obama than they were for his election originally?
I think the Obama high command and probably the delegates themselves realize that they have this is a sobering experience. It's not that giddy excitement of 4 years ago in Denver. I think they're very enthusiastic about him. Obviously, you've seen over the past few months constituencies that have been critical of him, liberal constituencies, labor, others, they all have rallied. I think that they're going to work hard for him. And in fact, the Obama high command said this morning that they have an even more intense outreach through their social network technology and all that other stuff than they did 4 years ago, and that they're going to make their ground game more impressive than ever this year. So, but I think, you know, you're just being realistic. You have to acknowledge that this is a much more sober, measured kind of a crowd than 4 years ago in Denver.
So what does the convention need to do to deal with the way that has become a central refrain, at least of the last week?
Well, I think it needs to send the delegates out of here more or less fired up and ready to go, as President Obama would say. They need to have speakers, and tomorrow night they're going to have one of the very best possible speakers to excite the Democratic base. That's Bill Clinton, and he knows still in his bones more about how to talk to people about the economy than almost any other public official of our lifetime, surely. And I think the Obama campaign has made a point of saying they don't know yet what the president's going to say, that it doesn't bother them that they don't know yet, and that they know he's going to kill. So I think that's a long way of saying he wasn't going to tell until the last minute anyway, so they might as well, you know, hope for the best.
Gosh, I think the Republicans had a little experience last week with trusting somebody who was such an icon they didn't vet his speech.
But he had never, in fairness, made a convention speech before, and I've been reliably told that there's not going to be any furniture on the stage tomorrow night of any kind.
Real or imaginary. Well, we have a caller question out there. Tell us about something from your own life that has helped to make you a Democrat. And our first caller is Harry in Detroit. Hi, Harry. You're on the air. Thanks so much for chiming in. Good. What's your story?
Good to hear. It's really a cute story. Back in 1964, I was 6 years old. And in those days, they would close school for election day. And I was probably driving my mother nuts. And we lived in a two-family house. And downstairs, we lived my grandmother, who we called Bubby. And so she said, go with to your grandmother and go help her vote. So I went downstairs and said, so when are we going? She said, well, whatever. We walked down the half a block to the public school. Had this massive voting machine with a black curtain with the lever, the whole business. And I asked my grandmother, can I come in with her? She said, no, it's a secret. So she went in. I stood outside. When she opened up the curtain, so I said, so, Bobby, who'd you vote for? And she didn't say a word. We walked about 3/4 of the way home. She stopped. She looked around both ways. And she whispered in my ear, Johnson.
So LBJ was the secret sauce in that case.
Indeed.
Your Bubby, your grandmother protecting her right to her secret ballot. But so was it sort of by inheritance then, literally, as opposed to kind of issue?
It probably was, because my mother prided herself on being a progressive Democrat, and that her first election, she voted for Henry Wallace in 1948, because he was ahead of his time. So this was the political environment in which we were raised.
All right, Harry, thank you very much. Let's go next to Juan in Tampa. Hello, Juan. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, boss. Yeah, I am originally from Texas, from the Corpus Christi area. And I attended Texas A&M, and I was always indoctrinated in the Republican conservative philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought less government, the standard Republican per se. Anyhow, what changed my mind from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party was I entered Arizona one day, and as a truck driver, I came into the port of entry in San Simon, Arizona, and female state worker asked me for my federal papers in a port of entry on I-10. That's when it opened my eyes, and that's the year that Sarah Palin and the Republican were running in, and I said to myself, there is no way I'm going to shoot myself. This man is from Arizona. Mm. I'm going to shoot myself in my foot,
John McCain,
and keep on voting Republican. These people are racist. That was my opinion when a state worker asked me for my federal documents.
You were profiled.
I was racially profiled, and I felt so offended. in a way, because it had never happened to me in Texas or any other state, I traveled through Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, and Arizona was the only place at that port of entry that asked me for my federal documents.
And John McCain was from Arizona, and there you went. Juan, thank you very much. It is a compelling story. And we'll get to more of your calls in a minute. So, Todd Purdom, you wrote an article recently that historically successful businessmen have made pretty unsuccessful presidents. Who are some of your best examples of that?
Well, Herbert Hoover, Warren Harding, Jimmy Carter were all big successes in business. Harding as a newspaper publisher, Hoover as a mining engineer, and of course Jimmy Carter as a peanut farmer and warehouse owner. And they each had one term as president. Harding didn't even live through his. He died in the middle of it. And I think one of the things that was interesting to me in the research is a lot of the qualities that are necessary for success in business are actually qualities of kind of diligence, and in some ways they're boring qualities of repetitiousness and willing to work long hours and do the same thing over and execute it really well, whereas some of the things we think of as necessary qualities for political leadership, charisma, the ability to persuade other people to your cause, top business people often don't have those. Now, I think the Romney campaign made the best case I've ever heard from them last week in Boston about the creativity that was involved in his business career and the kind of adaptability and the qualities of being able to roll with the punches. And those certainly are qualities that a president would need.
Of course, some very rich people have made great presidents by Democratic Party standards, FDR and JFK. And part of the argument this year is that Mitt Romney, by virtue of his wealth, is out of touch, some Democrats say.
I think that's a pretty unfair argument because, as you point out, some of our most successful presidents and our most empathetic presidents have been among the wealthiest ones.
Let's take another phone call. The question on the table, how has your life experience made you more of a Democrat? We did the same thing for Republicans last week during their convention. Let's go to Abe in Raleigh. Abe, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I'm glad. Thanks for having me. Grew up in North Carolina for the most part. And in the 60s, I watched LBJ push through the 64, 65, and 68 civil rights bills. And that impressed me that a Southern white man would do that, and I'm African American, would do that on our behalf. And he was a Democrat. That had a big influence on me. And then the other piece of it down here, we had a guy named Jesse Helms, who was not a senator then, but he was a editorial commentator on one of the big news programs. He had 5 minutes before Walter Cronkite every night, and he would get on and just lambaste all the civil rights stuff, just hammer it. And and he was very anti-black and anti-civil rights, and that left an indelible print on my mind. And later he became a U.S. senator in the Republican Party. And so those two things combined, despite my religious upbringing and that my values are very conservative, I felt that I had nowhere else to go but in the direction that I went.
That is some old story that I didn't know. Way before there was a Fox News channel, when Jesse Helms was a TV commentator, before being elected to the Senate, and before Walter Cronkite every night on the local CBS affiliate. Abe, thank you very much. Kevin in Akron. Hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What's your story?
So I became a Democrat after getting a job in corporate America. I had been in the Army for several years, and after I got out, I got my degree and got a really good job in corporate America, doing well in sales, and the atmosphere that I was in.
That's supposed to make you a Republican.
Yeah, right? You would think. So kind of Republican when I was in the Army, pro-military, thinking that Republicans are pro-military. So everybody around me in the Army, for the most part, were Republicans as well. Got to corporate America, and, hey, it was my crowd. Everybody's Republican. We're good. And came to the time for the elections for Obama for the, 2008 elections, and things started to change. I started to see how selfish these people were. It was a real critical point for me, just coming from not being as wealthy as some of these people were all my life.
I mean, the selfishness of the
corporate.
Right. So the selfishness of the corporate world, as you saw it, after being in the military, which is all about the community there, if that's the right word.
Yes, definitely. So, I mean, we were just worried about how it was going to affect us financially if we had a Democrat in office. And that was something that, really didn't matter too much to me. I mean, we a big debate we would have in our office, and I found myself on the other side of the debate. I found myself the Democrat in the office, but a lot of them felt that Medicare or medical insurance was a not a right. It was a privilege, and why should we have to pay for other people's medical insurance? But me coming from the military, I've always had free health care, 100% free. And after getting my job at this company, it was a great package, and I didn't pay much for it. I can afford it.
Kevin, I'm gonna move on, and I get it. That's a really interesting story, and not the first thing most people think of with respect to the military. Free medical care, but of course it's one of the things that comes along, and an interesting transformation story from Kevin in Akron. Listeners will keep taking your calls through the hour on the question, what experiences in your life has shaped your Democratic Party leaning politics? 1-800-543-2543. By the way, we have a great website with a whole gallery of people's stories, personal experiences that have shaped your politics from all kinds of political perspectives. It's at wnyc.org/issues if you're interested, wnyc.org/issues. And right here, 1-800-543-2543. Todd Purdom, when Barack Obama speaks on Thursday, it's a very different job for an incumbent president, right? Romney and Ryan had to introduce themselves to the nation in large measure. Obama has to address perceptions of him that he wants to change, that people already have.
Yes, 4 years ago, he had to pass the commander-in-chief test. He had to make himself seem like a plausible president. He had to cross that hurdle that this bright young guy with comparatively limited experience, and certainly limited experience in Washington, could really be trusted with the presidency. And obviously, he did that. Now, he's running on his record as all incumbents do. And his record is better than many people give him credit for, but it's complicated. And it's a hard sell for him and his team to say, oh, but you would have been so much worse off without me. Because proving a negative is always the hardest thing in politics, as in life. So I think his challenge will be to say, I do have a vision of where to go in the next 4 years. I have made big strides. You can trust me now the way you trusted me then. And I have learned on the job. And I wouldn't be surprised if he says a little bit about what he knows now that he didn't know 4 years ago. And how that will empower him going forward, give him more strength.
And in a minute before we have to take a break, how do you see Michelle Obama's mission tonight, and especially after Ann Romney appeared to be effective in her role last week?
Well, Ann Romney was effective just as Michelle Obama was extremely effective 4 years ago. She went, remember, from being a kind of a strange liability at a point in the spring of the campaign of spring of 2008. This woman who was caricatured as sort of an angry black woman might be a liability to the Senator Obama's campaign. She's now a beloved national figure with approval ratings far exceeding her husband's. She's had these initiatives on healthy eating and military family. She's traveled the world. She's a global figure. I was with her last summer in South Africa. She was received like a rock star there. She'll be received like a rock star tonight. And I think her challenge now is in some ways to rub off a little of her glow. Last time it was to humanize her husband, explain who he was, explain that he was sort of a regular guy like her, even if he was from Hawaii and had spent time in Indonesia and had a funny name. Now her challenge is to say he's really taking care of your American family the way he's taking care of my family, and you can count on him to do that.
Todd Purdom, national editor and political correspondent for Vanity Fair. He also blogs at vanityfair.com. Thank you so much for getting us off to a good start tonight.
Thanks, Brian. Everyone wants Wallace. Friendly Henry Wallace, 1948. That was a great slogan.
Listeners, tell us about something from your own life that has helped make you a Democrat as our coverage continues.
WNYC support comes from Incredible India, offering travel experiences in every season in diverse climates, from majestic Himalayan heights to tropic rainforests. More information available at IncredibleIndia.org or 800-953-9399.
The swing states get the good seats in the arena, while the loyal blues get the nosebleed section, a convention to woo battleground states. We'll let you hear the voices of delegates all doing their part in Charlotte, and an assessment of how the First Lady and the rising star mayor of San Antonio did at the podium. On The Takeaway, weekdays at 3 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
I I'm Amy Eddings. Stay with me and NPR's Jennifer Ludden for the major speeches at the Democratic National Convention tonight, including the one from First Lady Michelle Obama. The DNC on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio.
From WNYC in New York and the Mostly Swing States Radio Network, this is a convention night call-in. Hello again, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer from our Mostly Swing State stations, WNC North Carolina Public Radio, WUSF Tampa, WCPN Cleveland, Wisconsin Public Radio, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, WDET Detroit, and WAMU covering Washington, Maryland, and Virginia. We'll hear in just a couple of minutes from Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida. She is the DNC chair herself. But we'll get some more calls in first with things from your own life that have helped to make you a Democrat. And let's go to Imran in Baltimore. Hi, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yeah, I'm a truck driver, lifetime Republican, voted across the board Republican in every election because I'm pro-life. Well, when George Bush tried to tie 9/11 to the Iraq invasion, I knew that that was just idiotic. I also have been upset by if the Republican Party is so pro-life, why are they so eager to kill and torture and destroy lives? You know, it was the Iraq War that made me change to a Democrat.
Imran, thank you very much. Lori on Staten Island. Hello, you're on the air.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your story?
My story is I was a young woman in college many years ago, and I decided to have an abortion. And I was assaulted by a right-to-lifer, a movement I didn't even know anything about or didn't even know existed, at the doorstep of the clinic. And I was confused and sort of taken aback by this older man's insistence that I was making a bad choice, doing something wrong, ruining my life. And I was just appalled at the movement itself and still maintain, you know, that position very strongly as a middle-aged God woman now.
So you got personally protested against on your way
protested
in
on
to
very,
get your own abortion by an anti-abortion protester.
Yes. And I'm certain I'm not the only woman who's had this experience. Yeah. Unfortunately, I think it's an all too common occurrence that occurs by people who really have a very narrow viewpoint about a very, very difficult and personal decision that nobody really has a right to confront except the woman herself. And so for that reason and many others, but that was my defining moment about why I would never be anything other than an independent thinking Democrat.
Thank you very much. Well, we're asking for personal stories, and that certainly is a very personal story. We'll get to more of your calls as we go along here this hour. Now we will hear from two top Democratic Party officials. First, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I got to speak to her as the Republican convention was ending and after the attacks on President Obama as an economic failure. So I asked if she could argue that he's actually been a success.
I can defend President Obama's record as a success. Remember, President Obama inherited the largest set of problems at once of any president since FDR. And the economy was hemorrhaging 750,000 jobs a month when he first took office. Thanks to his policies, thanks to, for example, the Recovery Act, which put a tourniquet on that hemorrhaging and allowed us to stop the bleeding and began to get things turned around, his policies of fighting for the middle class and working families, cutting taxes 18 different times for small businesses, making sure that we make investments in infrastructure and keeping teachers, firefighters, and first responders on the job. That's brought us to a point where we've now made 29 straight months of job growth in the private sector. President Obama's focus on making things in America so that we can make it in America and has caused us to have more jobs created in manufacturing than any time since the 1990s. So we've made progress. We've got a ways to go, but we need to keep moving forward. What we don't need to do, and I think the dramatic contrast that exists on the two paths and the two visions that have been laid out, is that Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan want to essentially drag us back to the failed policies of the past, trickle-down economics that has been tried and failed, that nearly crashed our economy, and that focuses on millionaires and billionaires and giving them more tax breaks, paid for by the middle class and working families. And that's certainly not the direction that we need to go. That's going backward, and that's not what Americans want to do.
Here is something that Paul Ryan said in his speech, appealing to unemployed people in their 20s.
College graduates should not have to live out their 20s in their childhood bedrooms, staring up at fading Obama posters and wondering when they can move out and get going with life.
What would you say to that same unemployed 28-year-old with a Shepherd Fairey Obama hope poster on the wall?
What I would say to that young person is President Obama has made sure that when it comes to the lives of young Americans, that he's made their lives and improving their lives a priority. For example, by making a commitment to invest in education, particularly higher education, and increasing the amount of the Pell Grant available so that more, the thousands more young people can go to college, expanding the number of Pell Grants that were available, making sure that in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that young adults could stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26 years old. I've had moms stop me in the supermarket at home thanking me for President Obama's leadership on the Affordable Care Act because they were able to save thousands of dollars by putting their young adult children back on their insurance who'd lost their insurance under the old system. You're making sure that when it comes to a brighter future economically, that there are more job opportunities created because we've invested in small businesses and given them 18 different tax breaks so that they can hire again. So President Obama has made it possible for more young people to live the American dream, to make sure that if you work hard and play by the rules, that you can be successful. Well, and you contrast that with the Romney-Ryan plan, which actually cuts education, cuts college aid, cuts Head Start, essentially cuts the heart out of the future of the next generation and makes it more difficult for them to be successful and live the American dream.
With respect to the Affordable Care Act, which you mentioned, one of the biggest critiques is that it was the wrong thing to fight for at the wrong time, that we had an employment crisis and the president spent a year spending his political capital on a complicated health reform law that in addition has left employers more uncertain about the future. In retrospect, was that the wrong priority for the moment?
Well, President Obama rightfully prides himself on being able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And we don't have to deal with one important issue one at a time. While he was fighting for the middle class and working families, creating jobs and beginning to get this economy turned around and stopping the bleeding, we also made sure that insurance companies could not drop you or deny you coverage for pre-existing conditions any longer, that seniors would have that dreaded donut hole, the prescription drug coverage gap that thousands of them, the millions of them fall into and that caused them to have to choose between medicine and meals, that we'd close that donut hole and that coverage gap. Make sure that for breast cancer survivors like me, we wouldn't again have to be in a situation where when a doctor prescribes both radiation and chemo, that so many women have to choose one or the other because under the old system they couldn't afford both. That's what President Obama was able to do while ensuring that we lower health care costs and that we add 8 years of solvency for seniors in Medicare. So it was important because we did have a president who inherited the largest set of problems at once of any president since FDR. We needed to make sure that we had a president who was walking and chewing gum at the same time.
Last question, because I know you have to go. The Republicans say the hope and change president has not been running so much on the future as on making Romney seem unacceptable. Can you name the president's top three agenda priorities for a second term?
Well, I think Mitt Romney has done a good job all by himself of making himself unacceptable by embracing extreme policies. But President Obama's plans for a second term are to make sure that we can invest in education, that we can continue to create jobs and get the economy turned around by adopting middle-class tax breaks, by doing things like taking away the incentive the corporations have from tax policy to ship jobs overseas and incentivize them instead to bring jobs back here in America so we can make things in America again, that we can continue to focus on giving everybody a fair shot and everybody a fair shake so that everybody can have a chance to be successful, not just the people that already are. And those are the policies that he'll embrace, like education and innovation and health care and making sure that we have a president in the White House who doesn't just focus on people who are already doing well, that we focus on people who just want an opportunity to live the American dream.
Democratic National Committee Chair and Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz, chair of the Democratic National Committee, in an interview we recorded as the Republican National Convention was wrapping up last week. Our call-in question is still on the table, same as we did for Republican callers last week. Tell us about something from your own life that has helped to make you a Democrat. And Dave in Menominee, Michigan, you're on the air. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you. Well, I was raised in a Christian household and was sent to a Catholic school. And in the Catholic school, you know, we were taught to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked. You know, Jesus had told us, whatsoever you do to the least of my brothers, that you do unto me. And those values are now, if you go with a political party, are definitely not the values of the Republican Party.
Dave, thank you very much. And Rez in Chatham, New Jersey, you're on the air. Hi, Rez.
Thank you for taking my call. I feel there are many reasons why I feel I should remain a Democrat. I've thought the question through at every election. And the bottom line is that I came from a moneyed family. I arrived at my undergraduate school. It was a state school. And after the term bill was due, my family told me, guess what? The money is not there to pay for your schooling. You're on your own. So I went to the director of financial aid at my school. I was very stoic until I was admitted into his office. And that's when I broke down crying, telling them, I'm sorry, the term bill was due in August. It's now November. I haven't paid it, and I have no money. What do I do?
So it's the Democrats' commitment to financial aid. That's your personal
absolutely.
Story.
Rez, yeah, I feel personally rescued by that, yes.
Thank you very much for calling in. With us now, New York Congressman Steve Israel of Long Island from the Democratic Convention. He is head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which means he's in charge of seeing the Democrats try to take back the House from the Republican majority that swept in 2010. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Let me ask you first to reflect back on 2010. President Obama swept into office with a majority in both houses in 2008. And then the Republicans kind of cleaned your clocks in the midterm elections. As you look back on it, what happened?
Well, there's no question they did clean our clocks. There was this Tea Party tidal wave that overcame Democrats. We lost 63 seats in 2010. We lost 9 million independent voters who were with us in 2006, with us in 2008, and they weren't with us in 2010. There has since then been a deep and serious sense of buyer's remorse. They have watched a Tea Party Republican Congress that has continued to vote to protect tax breaks for corporations that want to ship jobs overseas instead of providing tax incentives for small businesses to create jobs here at home. They've watched this Tea Party Republican Congress spend 32 months trying to shut down Planned Parenthood instead of trying to open up small businesses. And finally, they've watched this Tea Party Republican Congress say that their solution to balance the budget is to ask seniors to sacrifice their Medicare instead of asking millionaires to sacrifice a little more. So taken in its sum, taken in its totality, Brian, you have this deep buyer's remorse that has put the House of Representatives back in play. We're on the 20-yard line. We see the goal, and in 63 days, we think we can win this majority back.
You're hoping the American people in enough congressional swing districts will see the Tea Party and their policies as too extreme now that they've been empowered. But let me ask you a comparison question. The Tea Party, mm-hmm. which wasn't even born until the president's term began, was unbelievably successful in becoming the driving force in the House delegation, and now they have one of their own, you might say, Paul Ryan, as the vice presidential nominee. At the same time, you have the Occupy movement outside the convention hall protesting against the Democrats in a bigger show of dissent than they made at the RNC in Tampa last week. How do you explain the two parties' different relationships with the liberal versus conservative grassroots groups?
Well, I'll tell you what. You take a look at the Democrats. You take a look at this convention. It is diverse. And whenever you have diversity, you do have some dissent. You don't have a monolithic view among Democrats. You take a look at what happened in Tampa. It was the Stepford Convention. They all look alike. They talk alike. They think alike to the far, far, far right. And quite honestly, Brian, we celebrate dissent. We celebrate our diversity. You know, we are the party that occasionally has some disagreements internally. That's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. What does unify us, however, is our relentless commitment to rebuilding a middle class. We know how to rebuild the middle class. The middle class under this Tea Party majority in the House of Representatives that has protected big corporations and their tax breaks every step of the way has taken it on the chin. And it's time for somebody to stand up and fight for them. And that's exactly what House Democrats are doing and will continue to do.
As chair of the Democrats' Congressional Campaign Committee, you have your work cut out for you right in your home state, New York. Speaker Boehner pointed out that New York is actually a swing state in terms of the number of House seats considered up for grabs. Here's that clip.
Whether it's up in Buffalo, up in the North Country, whether it's in Rochester or out on the east end of Long Island, we've got candidates who can win.
So how do you explain it in a state that will obviously vote overwhelmingly Democratic in the presidential election?
Well, I don't know what map Speaker Boehner is looking at. I can tell you that as a result of redistricting, and I say this not as the chairman of the DCCC, but as a New York member of Congress, as a result of redistricting, there is no such thing as a safe Republican district in New York anymore. Every single district that was a safe Republican district has now been put by the objective and nonpartisan pundits back in the toss-up column or the lean Democratic column. And so if you're Congressman Grimm in Staten Island and Brooklyn, if you are Congressman Gibson upstate New York or Congresswoman Hayworth or Congresswoman Burkle, strong Tea Party Republicans swept in by the Tea Party tsunami, you're looking at a whole mess of trouble in the next 62 days. And don't take my word for it. Listen to what they're saying. Hayworth and Gibson are now distancing themselves from the very Tea Party that swept them into their seats in two years ago. They may think that they can run away from their records, but we're not going to let them run away from their records. We're going to tie them to their votes to end Medicare in order to protect millionaires.
You know, American voters seem to default to divided rule over and over again in the last 30 years. When Reagan was in office, popular as he was, they kept a Democratic Congress. When Clinton was in office, after his first 2 years, they forced a Republican Congress on him. The Democrats took back Congress under Bush. And now under Obama, bam, a Republican Congress after 2 years. Is there something meaningful and abidingly centrist about this trend, in your opinion?
You know, I think checks and balances are generally good, but what the American people have seen over the past 2 years is a complete imbalance. I mean, what is balanced about a Paul Ryan budget that says that we are going to end the Medicare benefit, the Medicare guarantee for seniors, but expand tax breaks for the rich? What is good about a Republican? What is balanced about a Republican Congress? 167 Republicans voted against legislation that helped 9/11 workers get the medical attention that they deserve.
And
that
yet, at the same time, in our last minute or so, the president's two big policies, stimulus and the Affordable Care Act, seem to be too much big government for what most Americans wanted to see, drawing the 2010 sweep.
If you are a woman with breast cancer and you've just learned that your insurance company can no longer deny you the care that you paid for because breast cancer is a pre-existing condition, that's not big government. That's just plain fair. If you're a New Yorker and you just learned that your child can stay on your health insurance until the age of 26, that's not big government. That's just plain fair. And so the issue in this election, Brian, the defining issue is whose policies are best for rebuilding a middle class? Republican policies that consistently and relentlessly side with the rich and big corporations, giving them tax breaks to outsource jobs, or our policies, which consistently say that we need to invest in the middle class.
And
the economy should not go from the top down. It should go from the middle class out. And that is the basic and fundamental difference between the two parties.
I hear the chant in the background, four more years, four more years. So somebody's enthusiastic about the reelection of Barack Obama.
I think they were saying four more minutes for this interview.
I think it's four more seconds for this interview. So New York Congressman Steve Israel of Long Island, from the Democratic Convention, head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, trying to take back a majority in the House. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Listeners, our caller questions still on the table. Tell us about something from your own life that has helped make you a Democrat as we continue on the Mostly Swing States Radio Network.
WNYC receives support from
Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the best cancer care anywhere, where women with ovarian cancer receive multidisciplinary care from physicians specializing in gynecologic cancers, offering advanced treatment options. More at mskcc.org.
WNYC Listeners Legacy Circle member, Sandy Berger.
If I turn on the radio, it's WNYC. I don't listen to any other radio station. And there just came a time when I said, okay, they've done so much for me. Let's see if there's something I can do in return.
Find out how to name WNYC in your estate plan. Call 646-829-4587 or email legacygiving@wnyc.org.
I'm Amy Eddings. Our coverage continues at 8 o'clock. Join me in NPR News' Jennifer Ludden for all of the major speeches from the Democratic National Convention.
From WNYC in New York and the mostly swing states radio network, it's our convention night call-in. Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer. WUNC North Carolina Public Radio is in this network, along with WUSF Tampa, WCPN Cleveland, Wisconsin Public Radio, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, WDET Detroit, and WAMU American University, covering Washington, Maryland, and Virginia. Our caller question still on the table. Tell us about something from your own life that has helped to make you a Democrat. Same call-in we did for the Republicans during the RNC last week. And let's go to Katie in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Katie. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you very much. I grew up Republican, military brat, the whole thing. But my sense of social justice just really kind of took me over to the Democratic edge. I fell in love with the woman who became my wife in April 26 years ago. And so starting that battle here in North Carolina with Jesse Helms, I'm a long-term educator, career educator. I work in very minority, very high-poverty schools. And I see what the Republican policies are doing to the families of the kids that I serve. So social justice for me is exactly why I am a Democrat and will be for the rest of my life.
Katie, thank you very much. Ruthie in Mansfield, Ohio, you're on the air. Hi, Ruthie.
Yes, hi. Well, my experience was from the Vietnam era. I was in my mid-20s, young married wife. My husband was a Navy corpsman, and it was we weren't treated well in the military in those days. And on top of that, I watched as TV published pictures of Nixon ordering troops back home on one pier, and on the other pier, the ships were leaving with other troops. And also before the election, the military personnel got raises. So as a young person, I started to see our government being very manipulative.
With the way it used the military, including your husband, who was a vet during Vietnam.
Yes.
Or served during Vietnam. Ruthie, thank you very much. Well, with me now, Dave DeWitt, Raleigh Bureau Chief for WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Joe Ingles, Statehouse News reporter for Ohio Public Radio and Television, and Anna Sale from the National Politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Reporters, can you all hear me?
We can.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
So first of all, Dave Hewitt, the convention is in North Carolina, just as the Republican one was in Florida, because these are battleground swing states. But how is it supposed to rub off? I mean, regular North Carolinians are not in the hall any more than people from Wisconsin or Colorado or any other swing state.
Well, when this decision was made by the Democrats, North Carolina may have been a little bit more of a battleground state than it actually is now. Most polls have Romney leading slightly by anywhere from 2 to 4 points. There are a couple of Democratic-leaning polls that say it's a little more tight than that, that it's a toss-up. But this probably won't have much of an impact at all across the state, because where the swing voters are, where the independent voters are, are really in the suburbs of some of the metropolitan areas down here, in Wake County, here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg County. And with the convention coming in, you could see a possibility of some swing voters who might work downtown Charlotte, at least not this week, though, because it's been taken over by the Democratic convention. So even Democrats say now, and I've talked to several leading Democrats here in the state, that there won't be a huge bump coming out of this. No, they've got a great ground game, the Democrats do, in North Carolina. The enthusiasm is already there, at least with the hardcore Democrats. They are not expecting a huge bump.
Joe Ingles, you are in the center of the known universe. The earth revolves around you this week. The president was in Toledo yesterday. Paul Ryan campaigned in Cleveland today, I understand. Mitt Romney is scheduled for Findlay later in the week. With 11 swing states, Why, oh, why, oh, why, oh, is it so much about Ohio?
Well, you know, Ohio is a microcosm of the country. We have a lot of issues here that a lot of other states are grappling with, and we just seem to have all of them in one state. We're looking at, you know, a state that really has the metropolitan areas as well as the rural areas, the suburban areas, and it's a horse race here in Ohio. If you look at it, we've got Romney and Obama neck and neck in most polls, and it could go either way, although most polls show a slight edge for President Obama at this point.
Anna Sale, I gather you've been asking delegates are call-in question about things in their own lives that have helped shape their Democratic Party views?
I have, and I've found out pretty interesting stories. I mean, like the Republican convention, the people who are showing up here are longtime Democratic activists. They are not new to party politics, but for some, I actually met a 21-year-old delegate from Florida. He wasn't even able to vote 4 years ago, and now he's a delegate. And he says he decided to get involved because of a civics class in high school and made him a Democrat. His parents were Republicans, and now he points to things like his own Pell Grants and his sister's ability to have health insurance. She's got epilepsy as reasons that have kind of kept him active for the reelection of the president. But I also met another interesting woman. She was walking around the streets of Charlotte, downtown Charlotte today, carrying a sign that said, "This nurse supports Obamacare." So I expected she would be kind of talk about health care when I asked her why she was involved. She was also a first-time delegate. She was from Florida. But for her, it went way back. It went back to when she was a little girl in Trinidad and Tobago. I think we have some tape there.
Zita Dorjon Ishmalbegi, Satellite Beach, Florida. My mother and father had 18 children. And I learned at a very early age, you have to question everything. And when, because, you know, you have to open up your mind. And I watched my mother struggle. I watched her struggle for food, and I watched us struggle for education. And I watched my dad get very violent at times because he couldn't cope with so many children. And I always asked my mom, why do you have so many children if you can't take care of them? And it was culture. It was because their religion told them they couldn't have, you know, birth control, or they didn't want to. And I grew up, in my own mind, I think I became an activist at the age of 6. It always goes back to education. Everything in life is about an education, whether it's family planning, whether it's economics, whether it's being a doctor or a lawyer, whatever it is, it always goes back to the foundation of the home.
Foundation of the home, and a very big family in that home squeezed in, it sounds like, for that delegate, Anna.
That's right, and it's been interesting because you heard also in Tampa the Republican delegates talking a lot about being there because they wanted to preserve the American dream. They wanted to preserve opportunity in America. I'm hearing the same things from delegates here from a slightly different perspective. I just talked to a Vietnamese-American immigrant from Colorado who told me she worked 4 jobs and always said when she had time she was going to get involved in politics. And here she is. It's her first time convention. She was just sitting in the hall looking at all the women members of Congress on stage, just tears flowing down her face. So, you know, there are some poignant moments here.
I guess so. Joe Ingles, back to Ohio. There's a battle just fought over public sector collective bargaining that might spill into the presidential race. And here's a clip from an interview I did earlier today with Lee Saunders. He's president of AFSCME, the Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, in which he compares Ohio to Wisconsin, where, of course, the recall of Governor Scott Walker was a disaster for the unions and the Democrats.
If you look at Ohio, where we attacked it in a different kind of way, it wasn't through recall, because you can't have a recall in that state under the state constitution, but we did have an initiative. We collected over 1 million signatures to put it on the ballot, collective bargaining on the ballot, and we won by a 2-1 margin. So we learned a lesson from that, but I will say this. Our members are still fighting in the state of Wisconsin. We're still working in coalition with many organizations across that state. We're continuing to mobilize and educate and organize our members, and they will be involved in this election in November.
Lee Saunders, president of AFSCME, speaking to our swing state listeners in Ohio and Wisconsin. So Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio, what's the relationship between that fight and the presidential election?
Well, Lee is right. It was overwhelmingly appealed, that whole law that encompassed the firefighters, the teachers, police officers. It was public sector employees. And by a 2-to-1 margin, it was defeated. But we saw the labor unions really active at that time. And I remember going out and interviewing people as they were out there protesting. And one of the comments you heard over and over again at that time was, "I'm a Republican, but I had no idea they would do this, and I'll never vote Republican again." Now, the question is, this is a year later, are they going to vote Republican again? And we haven't seen the – I guess the thing is, we have seen the endorsements. If you look at the union groups, the teachers, the firefighters, the police, they're coming out. They're helping Democrats in most cases. They're out there doing their part, you know, providing ground game and that sort of thing. But what we don't see is the passion that we saw last year. And we don't see the mass numbers of people on the ground, you know, just complaining and holding rallies and that kind of atmosphere. That's just not there. And I don't know. I think one of the things that I hear all of the time in Ohio right now is people are just fatigued. They're tired of the ads. They're tired of the nastiness. They're really kind of shutting politics out. Many people say that.
Well, I guess.
And it's probably because we are a battleground state. We've been hit by a lot of ads and nasty, you know, and like you said, we have candidates here every week.
And we'll see if that battle over collective bargaining rights draws people to the polls again and has coattails in Ohio as the one with the opposite result does or doesn't in Wisconsin at the same time. Dave DeWitt from North Carolina Public Radio, relevant to tonight, and the presentation by Michelle Obama is the presentation last week by Ann Romney. Let me play a short clip.
I'm not sure if men really understand this, but I don't think there's a woman in America who really expects her life to be easy. In our own ways, we all know better. You know what? And that's fine. We don't want easy. But the last few years have been harder than they needed to be.
So if we're all in battleground states, women are the battleground gender in this election. What do you expect that's relevant to North Carolina tonight from Michelle Obama's speech?
Well, the gender gap here in North Carolina is actually smaller than it is in some other states, especially some other battleground states. And that's pretty interesting, actually, because that would be a place where President Obama might be able to pick up a couple of the undecided votes, if there are that many out there. You know, what's interesting is that North Carolina voted 35% of white North Carolinians voted for President Obama in 2008. Right now, according to most polls, he's anywhere between 30 and 32%. And longtime Democratic operatives in this state say if a Democrat can't win 35%, at least of the white vote, then it's going to be tough. So they're not focusing so much on women here because the gender gap isn't quite as large. They think they can make some inroads on some of the white vote, mostly in the suburban areas around the urban districts here in North Carolina. But that's really where they're focusing. You know, in the latest poll, you know, President Obama has 88% of the African-American vote. Mitt Romney has 1%. So that's not where the votes are going to come for President Obama. Where he's going to make up the slight difference that he has with a slight deficit is really in the white voters, and they may be women, but that's not necessarily their focus.
Anna Sale, do the delegates, especially the women delegates in the hall, want Michelle to respond to Ann Romney in any way, that clip we just played or anything else that she said, either in text or subtext tonight?
You know, I'm not sure about that, but something I've been struck by talking to women delegates is there's a real sense among many of them that the Planned Parenthood issues, the cuts to Planned Parenthood in Congress, that motivated them to get involved in a way that you know, it seems like it's sort of pushing back against that enthusiasm gap issue. I talked to a 60-year-old woman who said, "I wasn't as involved 4 years ago, but now I am." So it'll be interesting to see if Michelle Obama takes a similar tack that we've heard from the members of Congress who've already taken the stage, pushing really hard on issues of birth control, family planning, equal pay for equal work, or if Michelle Obama is kind of more broad, talking about pocketbook issues, the approach that Ann Romney took in Tampa.
And our caller question still on the table. Tell us about something from your own life that has helped to make you a Democrat. Christina in Durham, you're on the air. Hi, Christina.
Hi, how are
are you?
Good. What's your story, real quick?
Okay. I've been a Democrat since I was 8 years old. I grew up in a military family, and in the 1956 election, everybody around us was voting for Ike, of course, because he was a general, but my parents were supporters of Adlai Stevenson. My mom grew up in a farm, and she was a Roosevelt Democrat, and my dad was the son of Greek immigrants, and he said that the Democrats were the party of immigrants. And so I grew up knowing that it was really important, politics were really important, and that it was also important to stick up for what you believed in, even if everybody around you was going in the other direction, which I learned how to do again when I was a McGovern supporter during the war.
Christina, thank you very much. Let's go to Victor in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. I'm a U.S. citizen now, but originally born and bred in Africa. And during my youthful age, I did follow the Republican and the Democrats, and I felt the Kennedys touched my heart. And I felt the Democrats also were so much in love with minorities and especially foreigners. So when I got the chance to be in this country, I followed up, and I felt that I still believe the Democrats are more inclined to the minority problems, help, and whatever.
And to
so
immigrants.
That kept me into being a Democrat.
Victor, thank you so much for your call. So Dave DeWitt from North Carolina Public Radio, the Democratic keynote speaker tonight is Mayor Julian Castro of San Antonio. Do you expect him to strike the kind of note that Victor just did in his call?
I think he will. I think, you know, walking around this arena tonight, you feel a lot of enthusiasm and excitement, even for some of the earlier speakers. Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox spoke earlier, and he's a real rising star, at least locally or regionally here. He is, you know, has a really interesting personal story. He follows a long tradition of Democrats here in the South that have, you know, it sort of has ebbed and flowed a little bit, but he's come back, and Anthony Fox is sort of in that same realm as Mr. Castro. So there is a lot of enthusiasm here, especially for some of these speakers that folks don't know all that well.
But Joe Ingles, is there a risk of a backlash among that white working class block that the Democrats are also trying to keep in their tent enough in places like Ohio?
Well, you know, the working class in Ohio, one thing that has really affected them is this auto bailout. You consider one out of every eight jobs in Ohio are somehow tied to the auto industry. And Governor Strickland, the Democrats who were in charge at the time of the auto bailout, they advocated for this and got the money to go in there and save some of these businesses. And right now we're seeing, for example, the Chevy Lordstown plant is adding jobs. The Chevy Cruze that they make there is becoming one of the most popular cars.
Right. And so
that's really helping.
And so we will give the last word tonight to Vice President Joe Biden, who spoke in Detroit the other day with his answer to the question that the Republicans challenged his party with. Are people better off today than they were 4 years ago?
You want to know whether we're better off? I got a little bumper sticker for you. Osama bin Laden is dead and General Motors is alive. Osama bin Laden is dead and General Motors is alive.
Say it again, Joe.
Osama bin Laden is dead and General Motors is alive.
Anna, you're hearing that constantly in the hall?
I haven't heard it quite yet from the podium, but I'm sure we'll hear it again.
All right. Anna Sale from itsafreecountry.org, Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio, Dave DeWitt from North Carolina Public Radio. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And, folks, that concludes this convention night call-in. We will have another at the same time tomorrow. Also, we have an online chat going all evening. I'll be on that at itsafreecountry.org. Thanks for listening to the Mostly Swing States Radio Network. Coverage continues from NPR. And if you're interested in seeing a gallery of responses to the question, what kind of experience in your life shaped your politics in any way, we have that at wnyc.org/issues. Check it out at wnyc.org/issues. I'm Brian Lehrer. Our convention coverage continues.